The Music Business Worldwide podcast is supported by Volley Music, a leading financial management platform for the music industry. Volley enables you to track expenses, approve invoices, and make payments 24/7, 365 days a year. For your free trial, head to volleymusic.com. That's VOLYmusic.com.
Hello and welcome to Talking Trends, which, like all podcasts from Music Business Worldwide, is supported by Volley Entertainment, formerly known as Volley Music. My name is Tim Ingham, founder of MBW, and Talking Trends sees us dive behind standout entertainment industry headlines and give our quick take on them. Regular listeners to MBW's podcast will know it's been a while since we recorded a Talking Trends pod, but now we're back and with a new and improved setup. So here are the rules. On each episode of Talking Trends, I'm going to welcome someone whose views on the music business I respect and admire, and that guest will choose a topical subject that's been in the music business headlines, been in music business news, which we will then bat around. Before I choose a second topic, we do the same, and the episode will end. Today, and hopefully again in the future, I'm joined by Los Angeles-based Charles, or Charlie, Daughtry, a creative innovator in artist management, intellectual property management, and investments, which will be topical when you see what we talk about later. Charlie is a consultant and the founder of multiple businesses in music, including Daughtry Songs, CC Music Royalties, and Best Quality M&M, which manages the IP of legacy artists. He is an alumni of Columbia Records, Def Jam, Chrysalis Records, and worked for 2 decades at Disney Music Group in roles including head of catalogue and a director of marketing. He's worked with artists including Public Enemy, Tony Bennett, and at Disney for a long time. He led strategy for Queen and their brand. You might have heard of them. Charlie, welcome to Talking Trends. And in keeping with the rules I've just outlined, please pick a topic from recent music business headlines that you would like to discuss before digging in a little to your own thoughts on the matter.
Tim, I'd like to talk about the restructuring, which is running like a wave through the music business. Obviously, UMG had made an announcement of basically taking their multiple label strategy and condensing it to 2 mega labels, with the sub-labels being what were full-service record labels. It remains to be seen how deep the cuts will come, but inevitably, and I think they made the announcements that there are following on cutbacks at those labels that were put under the structure.
Just in case people don't know, you're talking about the fact that there was an announcement from Universal earlier this month that you're going to see Capitol Music Group has become part on the West Coast of a large label group headed up by John Janik. It will have its own dedicated staff. I'm sure you'll talk about that. It will have some autonomy, but it is part of a larger West Coast label group. And we've also seen the same thing with Def Jam on the East Coast become part of, as you say, a mega label group on the East Coast led by Republic Records founder Monty Lip. Sorry, Charlie, just back to you, just so people understand what you're talking about.
And look, there is an aspect of when these times come, the winners win more. So the people put in charge are those that tend to be doing probably the best job as they look across their portfolio. The reality is that these restructurings are falling quite hard on what you would call the traditional radio promotion. And it's unfortunate because I think that really good people will lose their jobs. At the same time, I would say it's been a decade coming because the tendency has been for the labels that have been stayed in business is to expand and add silos. If you look at the record labels' relationships with media, which includes from digital streaming services that program their material to traditional broadcast radio to whatever we would call print now, the fact is it's all exposure for their artists. It's critically important. It's an important service that they give to artists. It's one of the reasons that I think that labels have a strong future, because it's a very complicated and wide subject. But they've just added staff, and staff adds overhead. And when business is booming, as the streaming adoption has been the last number of years, that's great. When it starts to level off, overhead gets troubling. And there are very real worldwide investment amounts that need to happen, whether it's in Africa or South America or Asia. Territories that were not monetized are now being monetized. And smart music business people know that they need to open offices. They need to add staff. And when artists are getting compensated at a higher level, there's only so far they can go in overhead. And unfortunately, it comes to this point. I would have thought back when digital came on that they would have just added the relationships with the DSPs, the streaming providers, to the traditional promotion setup where you've got staff, you've got people who obviously have the skills to talk to programmers and the smart, and a lot of them very technologically oriented, but they didn't. And so now you've got some duplication and they're taking a hard look at things and shrinking the staff.
Warner Music Group has announced it's laying off around 600 people before September this year. Warner Music Group CEO Robert Kyncl has said the majority of those will come in owned and operated media, which is basically where Warner tried to buy and or launch written and video media platforms, which have nothing to do with this radio discussion. But the rest of them are clearly starting to bite in the labels, and that's happening at Universal too, and it's falling on the promo departments as well as other departments, but falling on the promo departments where, as you point out, there's duplication. Now, one area of Warner Music Group that is facing redundancies in the coming months is Atlantic Records, which has just announced around 25 layoffs are coming to that specific label, the New York label. The other day, the head of Atlantic, Julie Greenwald, explained the reasons for that restructure in a letter to employees, which ended up being published in the trade media, including MBW. In her letter to staff, Julie was saying effectively that this is because rather than have too many experienced and highly skilled radio promo people, I'm putting words in her mouth here, but that's what I took away from it, that they could cut some of that cost and then reinvest some of that cost in what she called SWAT teams around artists. And really, I think what she's referencing there is people to make behind the scenes video, people to film social content, people to take pictures for social content, et cetera, so that an artist is continually producing content. That's what I took away. She called them multi-talented ambidextrous people. That's what I took from that. Now, what I find interesting of that, just to go back to the Chance the Rapper example, which I know is becoming slightly outdated, but he had an extremely well-funded management team around him at the peak of his independent success. And I think that they would have been doing a lot of this so-called SWAT team action, that they would have been offering that resource to the artist. And I'm wondering if it's going to be interesting to see if more and more record labels follow Julie, and I wouldn't be surprised because they have in the past and she's smart what she does. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not there's actual duplication with it, what the record companies are offering versus what the established management teams are offering artists. And then the second part, which I'm just interested in your thoughts, you've been part of the industry, watching the industry for a long time, from back when radio was king to now when it still has a seat at the table, but perhaps doesn't wear the biggest crown. As recently as 2018, this is what it made me think, go back to the independent artist thing, AWOL, which at the time was part of Cobalt, they bought a radio promo company called Intune, based in New York. Yeah. And the big criticism leveled at AWOL at the time from the majors behind the scenes was, look, they're never going to be able to compete with us, particularly on radio. They just don't have the resource. It's all very well getting an independent artist up to a certain point, but they're never going to be able to explode them into the mainstream like we can. And buying Intune was AWOL's answer to that, really. That was as recently as 2018. I've also, just before we got on, because it's not to shock a listener, but we do share the topics we might be talking about, I looked at that Edison's Share of Ear report, that one where they look at in the US what different demographics are listening to, how much time they're spending. And it said that across all demographics, basically, this is from Q3 2023, so pretty recent, 37% of listening time was AM, FM radio. And that was more than streaming music services and YouTube combined. Podcasts, by the way, had about 11%. So 37%, over a third of listening time to audio was still AM, FM radio. So those things in the mix, I'm interested to get your view. The first part being, are record labels now trying to offer something that is sophisticated and well-resourced management teams already do for independent artists, and how that might affect the dynamic between those artists, the power dynamic between these artists and the labels? And the second point being about, are we rushing to assume that AM and FM radio is losing its power? I've just said it used to be king, when in fact, according to the stats, it's still heavily powerful in influencing an audience.
The funny thing is that historically, it's always been the case. Well-resourced, high-powered management. If you look at what Bernstein Mensch did for many years, they had their own marketing people. They brought on their own promotion staff, which they still have today. Not very lean. They would do it from a national point of view, but they would be guaranteed that they got the 100% of attention of at least key professionals that they believed in that had relationships at media. And so it's not new. Chance the Rapper famously did it because he had the funds to build from the outside, and they were smart and they did a good job. The reality is that it is a lot of overhead and you need a certain volume in your business. And when the cyclical nature of an artist who tours for X amount of time, whose music revenue from consumption goes up and down, it can start to bite. And there is the question of, do you have the resources? Are you wise to spend those resources? And how what's the definition of the word wise? So on the second part, which you were talking about, it's absolutely true. The thing about the music business is that for as long as I've ever had anything to do with it, everybody wants the one button that makes your career happen. And it's always been multifactorial. It is still doing live dates, even though YouTube and TikTok exist. It is still getting radio to the find your audience. The larger sense is that it's about building your audience. And this is something I'm very passionate about. It's about going to whatever the outlets are, and it's an aggregate of them. It isn't one that talks to your audience, so that assuming that you are really good and assuming you make material that can appeal to a wider audience, that your audience hears it wherever they consume it, and they don't consume it in just one place. There are multiple formats just in radio.
It is a heavyweight investment for a management company to surround the artist with some of these things. Julie Greenwald's letter said that they're going to be investing in, I've just got it here, I've managed to bring it up while we were talking, additional skill set in social media, content creation, community building, and audience insights for the average artist manager, maybe with a staff of 5 to 10. That's difficult, especially if you've got more than one artist. But I'm really talking about the super management companies, the Roc Nations, the Irving and Jeffrey Azoff level. But I need to move us on from this topic, although I have more to say on it, and I'm sure you do too, to our second topic this week, which I have picked. Obviously, I probably should be talking about Universal and TikTok. You've just mentioned TikTok, but I'm actually going to talk about Universal and something else entirely. And that is that Universal announced it had made a $240 million investment in Chord Music Partners, or Chord Music. And it's taking about a 25% stake for the $240 million. And it's the majority owner of Chord Music going forward, with KKR cashing out, will be a company called Dundee Partners, which is effectively the private investment family fund for the Hendel family. Stephen Hendel, the father, and Sam Hendel, who's very involved in the music business, very visible in the music business. This has really interested me for a couple of reasons, not just because Universal is now involved with outside capital and has made a minority acquisition of existing assets in Chord Music. There's about 60,000 songs in there, a lot of hits, The Weeknd's in there, some other stuff. But actually, because they've announced that they are going to grow this, they're going to be making acquisitions using a bit of debt and using a bit of Dundee Partners money, and I presume a bit of Universal's money as well, a minority piece of money. So Universal had its earnings call the other day, and Universal's CFO, Boyd Muir, was pretty clear that it seemed to me that all investments we will see, but certainly the majority of investments that Universal makes in the acquisition space going forward will be made through this vehicle. Now, that's really interesting because right now, I think when they did the press release announcing this deal, they said with debt included, Chord Music was currently worth about $1.8 billion. So that makes me wonder, wow, what's Chord Music going to be worth in 5 years, 10 years if Universal's in this for the long haul? Could it be worth $5 billion, $10 billion by the end of this process? That was the first thought. I've actually got an article coming on this next week. If you read that and you're listening to this, or vice versa, but it made me think about the EMI music publishing story. So 2012, you may remember EMI music publishing was taken over by a consortium that included Sony, who took a 30% stake, but it also included Mubadala. I think I've pronounced that correctly. So that was investment coming from the Middle East, and the Jackson estate ended up with a bit of it. And what happened with EMI music publishing, Sony bought Mubadala out, and it valued the company, that valued the whole of EMI publishing, at $4.5 billion. So run through those stats again. $2.2 billion was the value of it in 2012 when Sony turned to outside capital, Mubadala, to do the deal. And then 2018, Sony bought Mubadala out. EMI Music Publishing is worth roughly double what it was worth just 6 years before. And by all accounts, there's actually an interview in Nikkei with the CEO of Sony Corporation the other day that I read, and he was saying it was a brilliant deal. It's worth loads more than it was worth even in 2018. So that makes me wonder if that's going to be one of the outcomes here, that Universal ends up snaffling the rights once it's spent the money. The other part, which I have reported before, obviously, is that by coming together with Dundee Partners, Universal doesn't have to spend money on its own from its own balance sheet. And it has to balance off now because it's a public company. It's got a lot of shareholders who want to see nice, pretty large dividends. And they tend to come from the free cash flow, looking at the way that Universal reports its finances. And so obviously, if you're making large scale acquisitions, you're putting a dent in the cash flow, your cash pile, which may have a knock-on effect in short-term dividends. So it makes perfect sense to me why they've offloaded that off its balance sheet into a private company. But the third thing, which really fascinates me here, is I think this is all to do with the fact that Sir Lucian Grainger very famously doesn't like to lose. And because of Universal's policy, this is concurrent with it going public, Universal's policy of only acquiring rights where it has effectively full control of the assets. It's spending big money on the Bob Dylan deal. We've seen other bits and bobs. This is in artist catalogue deals, by the way. Lucian Grainger said publicly, we have a policy, and basically if we can't get full control of the asset, we're not interested. We see everything, we let most of it go, I think he said at some point. I'm paraphrasing there. What that has meant is that Universal's, yes, has a very clear distinction of how it's going to operate in the M&A market, the music M&A market. But over the past 2 years, even with the sort of interest rate difficulties that we've seen in that market and the slowdown in blockbuster acquisitions, we've seen Katy Perry sell her, I think, her recorded music income stream and her publishing rights in a nine-figure deal. Very recently, we saw Rod Stewart sell his assets. I think that was his recorded music income stream. I don't know about the publishing, if it was rights or it was an income stream, but still, that went elsewhere. Justin Bieber very famously did a sort of $200 million deal with Hypnosis, the Blackstone private part of Hypnosis, at the top of, gosh, the years are flying by, but I believe that was the top of 2023. And we saw towards the end of last year, Enrique Iglesias sold a bunch of rights. And these are all artists. Rod, in the case of Rod Stewart, I think he's a personal friend of Sir Lucian Grainger. These are all artists operating within the Universal ecosystem. And I think moving together with Chord gives Universal the ability to not see these rights walk out the building again. Interestingly, as part of the Chord music deal, they've actually brought a bunch of The Weeknd's publishing from his first six albums into the Universal ecosystem, and Universal basically operates or represents the whole rest of his catalogue. So you can see the thinking there. The question I want to ask you, Charles, off the top of all of this, and obviously please feel free to give other observations, but I'm interested in who Universal's done this with, because it hasn't done it with Apollo or BlackRock or a giant of Wall Street. And I'm sure the offer was there. We've seen these entities active in music already. And why wouldn't you want to be in bed with the largest music rights holder, arguably the most powerful music company in the world? And also, we haven't seen them do it with a sort of sovereign fund. We haven't seen it do it with a Mubadala-esque company, or indeed Mubadala itself. They've gone for what is really quite, when I say the word private, I mean both in structure, but also in the way that Dundee Partners doesn't shout about itself. It's made investments, got made consistent investments in music before. It owns Partisan Records. It owns a bit of Cobalt. It's made an investment in that jukebox company, which is looking to effectively trade music like on its stock exchange almost. So it's made these investments in the past. But for Universal to choose Dundee Partners is a hell of a vote of confidence in Dundee Partners and how Dundee's capital and its ability to leverage debt is going to grow that portfolio. So that's why I'm really interested in here. Why do you think Universal might have done that rather than going for a large sovereign fund from Saudi Arabia or with BlackRock?
Well, a couple of things on that. When you look at any capital partner, you have to consider what their goals are. You have to take off your hat about why you're doing it. And you have to remember the KKRs of the world, the Kohler Kravises of the world, the venture companies, they're inherently not long-term. They always have a 5 to 7 year window. And if you look at some of the earlier deals, it's probably that the music company is looking at it. It's a rising market. I feel confident about being able to grow the revenue of this company. And so in some way, I'm going to be able to pay, even though I'm going to pay a higher amount to buy it out, I know that in 5 to 7 years, this partner wants to get out and I'm going to purchase that. And then I'll own 100% or 80% or 75%, but I'll be the majority partner. I 100% agree with the points you made. And the advantage of family offices is they tend to have a longer view of these things. And whether it's, if you look at the great benefiters of the time when there weren't a lot of people investing in, I'm a huge fan of the Khosrow Shahi family, who made Reservoir, which was nothing as a new company in a time when you couldn't really do that. Even, and the people that sold have been kicking themselves for the last 8 years or so that they sold at the time, but it's natural for people to run into those things. So if you look at Dundee, you look at Universal, I agree with you that control may have, I don't know, some negative aspects, but they already have a multi-factor deep relationship with particular catalogs. They're very important to them. They're doing a lot of the work. Love them or hate them, record labels do a lot of the marketing and promo work and the hard blocking and tackling, as well as collecting the money around the world. So it makes sense that if they feel strongly about the prospects of a catalog, that they'd want to have more of the rights. It just makes complete sense to me. And the family offices, and it's many of them aren't at all. They don't have expertise in the area. But these guys had made some investments. They obviously were enthusiastic about how that had gone and the prospects of the music business. So it would seem to be a good partnership. There's no conflict. It's not somebody that's coming in as a per se music business expert. That's UMG's role. And they are a stable financial partner, and they're not going to turn around because something happens on Wall Street in 18 months and say, yeah, I know we said we were going to be in for 5 years, but we can only be in for three. and want to pull their money and get their money out, which does happen.
We saw a hilarious example of it with Chord itself. I wrote this the other day. I just brought it up in front of me. In 2021, KKR issued a press release announcing Chord Music. At the time, Chord was majority owned by KKR and minority owned by Dundee Partners. The press release, so this is October 2021, 27 months ago, the press release from KKR said that the deal would connect the works in this portfolio with long-term owners. And 27 months later, KKR sold.
Well, exactly. And so it's like, remember, money was cheap and it was fairly easy for the venture companies to look like heroes because they could expand the multiple and they have leverage, they have financing tools they bring to bear, and there was cheap money. And if they expanded the multiple, they do great. They do phenomenally well, but they're not operators. And operators have a frustration when something like that happens, because think about if you had a fantastic music company, you're building it great, that's your partner, and all of a sudden interest rates have gone up, and now everything that they said is no longer true, and it puts you in a terrible position because maybe you don't have your financing together. Now, UMG has the best access around the world, so they get to choose which partners they're going to be with. And if you think of any of the potential negatives of the other partners, the family offices have the least. When I don't know Dundee Partners, I have no particular inside view of how they operate, but it is a big endorsement from Universal, who are very sophisticated in this, that they really believe this is the right partner for a substantial acquisition that has important artist rights attached with artists that are important to them beyond this deal.
Perhaps I have much more to say on this. I mean, we could talk about what Boyd Muir said on the earnings call. I will say very briefly that I think he said they paid, Universal paid a seven, it works out to a 17 times EBITDA valuation of them buying their stake. But he said that factored into that valuation, so obviously Universal is going to get an uplift from being the distributor of the recorded rights and the administrator of the publishing rights as and when they expire. They typically go through Cobalt at the minute because there's a historic relationship there. But Universal hasn't factored in how much uplift it believes it's going to be able to bring to those rights as Universal Music Group. You know, you take a lucrative recorded music and you give it to the company with the most offices of any company in the world. That could lend to a natural uplift tomorrow. Anyway, there's so much more to say, but I did promise at the start of this podcast that we would keep it short. So I'm going to have to stop us there, Charlie, but please come back and join me on this because I've really thoroughly enjoyed speaking to you. And that is the end of Talking Trends. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you.